I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the second part of a conversation or a dialogue called 9/11 and the Global Community, conducted by four distinguished Canadian professors, Anthony Hall, Michael Kiefer, John McMurtry, and Graham McQueen. The conversation you're about to hear was given at the Center for Globalization Studies at the University of Lethbridge in Canada and was posted on YouTube on January 2009. So let's begin.
Even Iraq, Saddam Hussein was put into power by, was a paid employee of the CIA. And he was put in there because actually they had had a socialist government that had used all their oil revenues for public health and public infrastructure, free higher education for all and so forth, and really had the most flourishing economy in the Middle East and Central Asia in the world. So that we never heard about. Well, that I would say was an inchoate beginning to be life economy, but it was attacked by including Saddam, but he couldn't take that away from them. The only way they could take that away really was to bomb them back as they did from 1991, deliberately destroying all their life infrastructures and so forth. So that when you go to the life economy, though we've never really seen it consciously develop that way, people are normally into that. People are out like that as individuals. That's what they hope for their children, for their old age and so on. And that whenever it starts to be instituted, that's what gets attacked. That is what's called the enemy. And we've seen the same thing go on inside our own society, where we demonize any social programs and so forth and use the deliberately created deficit. That's a story in itself. Deliberately created deficit to cut them all back and so on. So the taboo seems to be to say anything that calls into question the ultimately regulating value system of the society, and the more it does do that, the more it'll be taboo or unspeakable. And what seems to be most taboo and most unspeakable, in fact, is eradicated from the First Nations people on, is anything that actually attends to a life economy. Life and working for means of life for more life. That seems to be what is most of all forbidden. From the past, we learn the present. The same sort of mechanisms of operations of repression of any such information is just, it's ruled out as unspeakable. And in this way, virtually any conspiracy theory can flourish, because anything that contradicts it, or more basically the interests it represents, is eradicated as basically the enemy. And I didn't mention to you guys, but when I first just brought up the issue of cui bono, which is a principle of forensic law, which is the first thing when you have a criminal site, a criminal occasion, the first thing you do is ask the question, it's just standard process, who benefits from this? That's what cui bono, to whom the benefit? And that's a standard question that you ask in any criminal situation. Well, obviously, there was a lot of benefits that were going to the Bush administration, who had just stolen an election, as we later learned, through electoral fraud, who had also was presiding over what was a deep slide in the stock market, whose president had had as his major backer the biggest corporate fraud in all of American history, the head of Enron, and Ken Lay. And he was basically, and there was a whole anti-globalization movement that had become out of control. You remember Quebec City, also Genoa, 500,000 people on the streets. So I just asked the question after the war, because I gave a keynote address to Science for Peace at University of Toronto, at which a lot of people were there, and just said, pose that question. What are the benefits? And then there's anomalies around the questions of just how did this whole thing happened, buildings collapse at the speed of greater than the speed of gravity and so on. And just by asking that question, I was, for somehow it got around into the American press, and I was being called Osama McMurtry by the Wall Street Journal in its editorial, like within 24 hours. My university had hundreds of emails denouncing me, including an ex-colleague. And the Globe and Mail wrote two ferocious editorials from two different people. And all I did was ask the question, cui bono? So that's how you stop. That's how you stop the unspeakable. That's a taboo.
Yeah. Graham, you were going to intervene at some point and say that you could see a very neat connection to 9/11.
No, I will speak for a minute. I want to do something fairly simple, which I hope will fit in with what John was saying, which I thought was very insightful. And that was just that I was watching CNN coverage of 9/11 the other day. Fortunately, I have the whole thing downloaded on my hard drive, so I can actually go through the whole of 9/11. We have this for several broadcasters, and I urge you to do it. It's very interesting if you're especially somebody who's used to close reading, meaning that you know how to watch things very carefully and to see what's going on. So I'm watching CNN as the events unfold. And
now, wait a minute. You're watching 9/11 as they were reported on CNN?
Yeah. Sorry. So it's been archived. I've got it on my hard drive. I'm sitting at home watching it, watching the actual original 9/11 coverage as the events unfold. So there's four little things I wanted to briefly mention that I saw that I found interesting. First was they dragged old Alexander Haig on during the day. Now, I forget, Secretary of State, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So you may not remember him, but former Secretary of State Alexander Haig is being interviewed. What does he think? This is while the event is still going on. The cameras are kind of panning to huge clouds of smoke in New York and, I guess, more smoke from Washington. What does he think? And I'm not saying the old guy was in on it. I have no idea. Like, I really don't know the names of who was in on this, but he seemed kind of happy that America could finally get its priorities straight. And he said, you know, there's been so much talk in America about social justice and so on, and spending so much time on that kind of issue. And now we know what really matters, and it's terrorism. That's what really matters. Now we can get our priorities straight, and we can go after terrorism. And I thought, how interesting, because of course it's true that there was a great upwelling of movement for global social justice. And some of it was called the anti-globalization movement. And it had massive street demonstrations and nonviolent civil disobedience. And it had captured the public imagination. And it had people who were skilled at symbol and narrative. And what happened? Then we got 9/11 with all the what shall I say, symbolic power of shock and awe. Violence is the ultimate scene stealer in these kinds of things. We don't care about your anti-globalization CD, civil disobedience anymore. Look what we've got. We've got planes crashing into towers, human beings on fire leaping out of a 110-story building. Can you beat that one? You know, the symbolic power of this. And so there's Alexander Haig saying, now we know what the real priority is. It's terrorism. Now think about that for a minute. Like, think about, I was looking up the other day, well, let's look at, say, 2003. That's the year they invaded Iraq. How many Americans were killed through acts of international terrorism? According to their own, they have an institute that counts this stuff. 15. 13 of whom were killed while they were in the Middle East or Afghanistan. How many Americans were killed in traffic accidents that year? 42,000. But again, going back to John's point, the 42,000 we don't care about because that's just the price. That's the price we all accept for the petroleum economy and the money makes money economy and so on. But the 15, says Alexander Haig, wow, that's where we really have to give our attention. Now, of course, when you raise that with people, they'll say, well, there may have only been 15 that year, but 9/11 there were 3,000. Yeah, but who killed them? That's the question. That's the question, and that's what I hope we'll get into talking about later. Second thing I looked at, Senator John McCain. Now, there may have been somebody else quicker than him to make this point, but he was the first one to make it on CNN, as I recall, and that is that he said, this is an act of war. Now, this is a very important comment. Bush himself made the comment, I believe it was the next day in his official speech, but McCain was already saying it on 9/11. And actually, the CNN reporter was fairly sharp with him initially when he said, this is obviously an act of war, and she said, why? He didn't have anything to say. He didn't have a definition for war, nothing. Just puffed and fumed a little bit. It was an act of war. But you have to see how important this is. Because, of course, it could have been defined, for example, as a crime. The things that were done on that day were, in fact, crimes under international law and could be dealt with as such. The U.S. government had agreed to support the International Criminal Court, for example. There were all kinds of things that could have been done. When you define it as war, then that's when the military-industrial complex can do its thing. We know the United States is the most powerful state in history when it comes to war. I'm talking in absolute, not relative terms here. The ability to annihilate everyone. So naturally, that's the game these folks are good at and the game that they were clearly keen to play. And you could see that McCain was itching to play that game, and that's what they did in Afghanistan and Iraq. The third thing I wanted to mention is journalists on the scene for CNN talking as it happened about witnessing explosions in the towers. Oh, it just blew up. This kind of thing. They've been silenced. They're no longer supposed to be part of the record, but there they were. There's a lot of journalists, both the anchor people and the people in the field, who are saying, my God, things are being blown up. And it's quite intriguing to me when, you know, think about the implications when our society says, well, we don't care what people are actually perceiving with their senses. We don't care. Even if it's your broadcaster, it's your own journalist who's saying, I watched it blow up. You silence them. See, to me, this is really a dangerous point for a culture. When you begin saying you don't care what people perceive, you're more interested in the official line. And that brings me to my fourth point, and that is the classic point on CNN when the anchor says, oh, I'm just receiving some new news here that a third building, I believe it's World Trade Center 7, has collapsed or is collapsing. And then he looks at his little screen, and it's just standing there.
It's announced on BBC 20 minutes before it happens by a journalist who's standing in front of the building.
That's right.
World Trade Center 7, that it's already collapsed. That's and there's right. The building behind the person, and it's 20 minutes before it
That's correct.
Collapses.
In CNN, it's more than 20 minutes before. This is about an hour in advance when its collapse is announced. And my last point is, then over the next hour, we keep getting the camera going to World Trade 7, and we keep getting a thing at the bottom of the screen, World Trade Center 7 on fire, may collapse. And then finally, about 15 minutes before it gets down, the thing changes to World Trade Center 7 poised to collapse. And then it's on the verge of collapse. And then, of course, it finally collapses. Now, the thing that's odd about that is, according to the official U.S. government report on 7, this was a completely freak thing that a 47-story skyscraper made of steel would come down from office fires. It's the first time in history. And they say that this can only be explained according to a bunch of freak things that happened at the last few minutes. And there's CNN. Somebody knew well in advance. So those are just four things I wanted to say from watching just a few hours of that CNN coverage, which I think reinforced this disturbing notion that certain data that we receive will be given no place in the system because they somehow contradict the core, I'm not sure what you call them.
Well, the regulating group mind.
The regulating group mind is fine by me. Yeah.
Well, the regulating group mind was also, I'm not sure if it was it CNN or was it another network that had that bizarre little moment when immediately after the collapse, I think, of the South Tower, there's a man in a baseball cap who's being interviewed by the journalist, and he says, I saw, and he speaks like an actor. He speaks like a kind of sitcom actor, not a very good actor, perhaps. I saw the plane go into that building, he says, and because the steel was being melted by the kerosene, the building just couldn't stay up, and that's why it fell. So he was obviously there to implant that notion.
But imagine being hired to implant a notion that violates the laws
of
physics.
Of course, yeah.
Yes. But that reinforces Graham's point. It just doesn't matter. Laws of physics are suspended too.
I think your sense of it immediately was that the official version...
I never found the official conspiracy theory plausible. How would they know who did it? I mean, and who benefited from this? Those were the questions. And then, and the more you got into it, the more you just couldn't believe it. It wasn't until later on that I realized, when physicists started telling me, do you know also the building went down faster than gravity? And then you just go, oh my God. So every time anything new came up, what you do when you're making a rational hypothesis is you look for disconfirming information. I mean, that's a scientific method. The hypothesis, one is the official conspiracy theory. So you look for evidence that will confirm it, and you look for evidence that will disconfirm it. I could find no evidence that really confirmed it. Then the alternative hypothesis, which gets generated by the fact that the official conspiracy theory isn't explaining it, everything you find out actually confirms that the official one, disconfirms the official one, and starts to confirm that something else went on here altogether. And the question is, which we haven't posed tonight, how can you do it? Like, to say X occurred entails that those who did it were capable of doing it. So the evidence for, you know, the alternative hypothesis, it isn't the way everything that official conspiracy theory is saying is disconfirmed by the evidence. Now, what does the evidence imply? And I really looked hard to find anything that did confirm it. Like, for example, if anybody got harmed that was from the whole Bush oil military complex, anybody in that whole complex get harmed financially or morally or any other way? No. So I was looking for something, because that wouldn't tend to indicate that, well, if it conflicts with their interests, conflicts with the interests of the people who are pulling this off, then that will take the light off them. But I really couldn't find anything that indicated that everything that went on wasn't completely in their interests. On the other hand, all this evidence that you'd come up, like, you know, the removal of the evidence, the fact that they knew who did it before they had any evidence for it or any conceivable evidence for it. And then, as I say, asking the question, for something to happen, the people who did it have to be able to do it. And hearing from Max von Bülow, who I'd signed documents with, he was a former Minister of Defense or the equivalent in Germany, and he said it was impossible that this action could have been performed by anything but a highly sophisticated apparatus of which only a major state would be capable, or words to that effect. So that made you think, again, well, who's capable of doing it? And so you say, well, because I didn't think that they did it. I thought they perhaps had let it happen. But the more you got into the evidence, then the more it was confirmed, well, they were the only people who were capable of doing it. And so I just leave you with the question, who's capable of doing it? And that will have to be where the evidence points towards, as well as in whose interest it is.
That's a question of the structure of the event.
Yes.
Because the event in the New York spectacle of the event consists of this shock and awe of buildings struck by large aircraft and then collapsing. But for that to occur, you first have to have the entire air defense system out to lunch,
yeah.
Disabled, stood down, or whatever.
Stood down.
And it's quite obvious that it's not within the power of a non-inside authority to do that to the American defense system. And then, of course, the evidence that emerged in 2004 was that indeed they were conducting this nesting series of concurrent military exercises that had precisely the effective function of disabling the whole system.
Yeah.
They had aircraft that were off in Iceland for one exercise, in Alberta and Alaska for another one. So they'd thinned out the number available. And then they had the computer screens of the military air traffic controllers filled with blips from a hijacking exercise, so that for the crucial time, they didn't know what to do with the comparatively small number of remaining fighters, where to vector them. The structure is a very powerful disconfirmation of the official conspiracy theory and confirmation,
yeah,
at the same time of an alternative,
yes,
hypothesis.
It's a very simple thing. If it got done, somebody or people or some agents were capable of doing it.
And another coincidence was FEMA, the very dark and secretive agency that Peter Dale Scott, for instance, includes as part of this continuity of government. He says that since 9/11, the Constitution has been changed. There was some secret transformation of the governing structure of the United States that is still in place. But FEMA officers arrive on September the 10th for an exercise on September the 12th. So they have arrived there, and of course then they become responsible for cleaning it up, but some would say wasn't really a matter of cleaning it up. It was a matter of removing the evidence, taking the steel, carting the steel off as quickly as possible and removing the evidence. So this is Adnan Zubairi, and you two are involved in engineering and the University of Waterloo 9/11 study groups.
Hi there. I'm in mathematical physics, and I created the UW 9/11 research group with the help of really good friends. We started off by first coming together. We didn't form a group right away. First we got to know each other, and then we called up John and Graham and Michael as well, and they were very helpful and supportive, and we created a very massive conference at the university that really shook the university. What we found was that about 400 people came out to the conference. And I believe that was one of the largest numbers of people that have ever come to a North American 9/11 related conference. What we saw was that from the polls and the statistics, about 95% of the people disagreed with the official theory of 9/11, and the numbers were really high, suggesting that there was a media cover-up and so forth. So we realized that there are a lot of people that are on our side, and we have to connect to them. So that's where the student groups come in. And there's our website. The website is really professional. We found that our goal is to try to appeal to academics in the community. And by having a really well-structured website, what we do is, on a bi-weekly basis, members of the group go in, we speak to professors in different faculties. We've gone to civil engineering professors, we've gone to history professors, and we've accomplished about 30 of them. What we found was about 25 or 27 of them had extreme doubts. After 2 minutes, though, after talking with them after 2 minutes, then they let it out. At first, they pretend like they don't know anything, but then they let it out, and they're like, there's no way those buildings came down, son. So I've heard that a lot of you might have an interest in activism or are already taking part in it. And I would suggest to try to think about forming a University of Lethbridge 9/11 research group, expand the chapters. Professor Michael Kiefer recently was at the University of Toronto. He gave a very informative, eloquent speech, and I believe that created the UFT 9/11 chapter. So you'll find that many students there at Lethbridge share the views that we have as well, and they'll come together.
I'd like to welcome Josh Blakeney. He took both versions of the Globalizations course last year. Josh, could you introduce the person you've brought into the conference?
Yeah, Ahmed and I are quite new friends. We met this semester just casually talking about various matters and invited Ahmed if he'd be interested in taking part in this conference, because I think, you know, it's pretty important that we don't just gloss over this as, I think a lot of students find it's easy to be cynical about these things. Oh, sort of what if they did do it, but, you know, 100 Canadian soldiers have lost their lives and 1 million Iraqis have lost their lives and many Afghani people and many people throughout the world have lost their lives as a result of this, you know. It's not just, oh, well, this hasn't affected us in Lethbridge, well, you know, big deal sort of thing. I think this is globalization studies class, and if we look at it globally and holistically, then this is an important issue, and therefore I find that just casual conversations with people adds to the discourse on this. And I'm open-minded. I just want to learn more about this because I really know very little, actually. So,
Professor Kiefer did work and is a renowned scholar in the field of Renaissance literature and the demonization of witches in some of the literature that Professor Kiefer studies. Gives an interesting link into 9/11 and how essentially we've seen an event whose interpretation demonizes, could we say, the Muslim world, the Arab world. I've never really seen a war where the enemy is defined in such vague terms, in such undefined terms, that it really can be directed wherever those pursuing this so-called war on terror want to take it. Give us an introduction to the Canadian dimension of the war on terror, if you would, please.
Yeah, there are two crucial aspects here, I think. Two things we need to reflect on. One is Canada's involvement in the occupation of Afghanistan. We have lost something like 100 lives. Now, that's a minuscule number compared with the numbers of civilians who've been killed by the American forces during the invasion of Afghanistan and subsequently by the occupation forces supplied by allies of the United States, including Canada. First thing to say about that war is that it is unambiguously illegal in terms of international law.
Supreme crime.
Exactly, John. Yes. In terms of the Nuremberg laws that are an accepted part of international law, it was a war of aggression, of unprovoked aggression, and that is the supreme crime against the law. So we could go into some detail if we wanted, I suppose, as to the different aspects of the history immediately prior to the invasion, the manner in which the media misrepresented the situation in collaboration with the misrepresentation circulated by the American government. Fact is, though, for present purposes, the invasion was flagrantly illegal. The occupation is therefore illegal. Canada is involved in an ongoing and grave violation of international law in Afghanistan. And the situation is exacerbated by the further violations of international law that are involved in the details of our occupation. For example, the fact that Canada is a signatory to the Geneva Conventions and the puppet government of Karzai in Afghanistan is not a signatory to these conventions. Those conventions therefore prohibit Canadian soldiers from handing over any prisoners they might have to a non-signatory power. That is, of course, exactly what we've been doing, and there's significant evidence that many of the people arrested by Canadian troops who are illegally there, illegally handed over to Afghan authorities, have been treated in, they've been murdered, they've been tortured, they've been subjected to horrors of various kinds. So that, I think, the degradation of international law is, I think, a very key part of the war on terror. There's a very interesting commentary in the current issue of Harper's Magazine by a distinguished American lawyer, Scott Horton, who re-describes the war on terror as a war against legality. Now, the occupation of Afghanistan is one aspect of this, and it is a matter that should be a cause of grief to Canadians, grief at the needless deaths of a number of our young people, grief at the irreparable harm suffered by hundreds more of our young people. I'm thinking here of psychological harm as well as of the bodily wounds they've received. But grief beyond that at the fact that in a war of occupation, of civilian insurgency against military occupation, you have the kinds of asymmetries that are constantly in the news when we read of, for example, young men and women who are perhaps thousands of miles away guiding drone aircraft that are cruising around over Afghan airspace, mistaking a wedding celebration for, you know, a terrorist gathering, and directing 250-pound or 550-pound bombs or missiles into the middle of wedding celebrations. You have routine stupidities of that kind. You also have routine acts of collective punishment and violence against civilian collectivities of a kind that are expressly prohibited, again, by international law. So this should be a source of, I think, of grief to us, both that we are inflicting grave damage upon innocent people, and grave damage in part through the kinds of weaponry that we're using. Remember that when Canadian troops, let's say on patrol, get into difficulties, they're perhaps ambushed by insurgents, or whatever it might be, they receive incoming fire and so on, they call in air support. What does the air support do? The air support hoses down the area in question with depleted uranium ammunition. Now, we know a great deal about the effects of depleted uranium ammunition. It amounts to a form of what we can unambiguously call nuclear warfare, because that stuff gets spread everywhere, and it does permanent damage to the population of the area against which this ammunition is used. Now, that is an inextricable part of the structure of our involvement in Afghanistan, and it's something that I think Canadians ought to find completely intolerable.
Tune in next week to hear the next part of this conversation with the Canadian professors. And now I want to remind you that architect Richard Gage, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, will be speaking in West Hartford as part of his 30-city tour on Sunday, June 17th at 7 p.m. You can get tickets by going to the website 911expertsspeakout.org, and you can also purchase them at the door. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.